أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على سيدنا وحبيبنا حبيب إله العالمين محمد، اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المنتجبين. We started talking about the type of interaction which we are advised to adopt by the Islamic teachings, the type of interaction with people. Now, we talked about forbearance last night, al-hilm, and of course we are going to talk about af, forgiveness as well. However, before that, before moving on from tolerance and forbearance, I would like to mention one quotation from Salman al-Farsi. Salman, you know, is a very interesting personality. Of course, he was Iranian. That's what the important thing about him. He was Iranian. But, you know, he was raised in an aristocratic family with Zoroastrian background. He learned everything about it. Then he was not satisfied. He traveled and he became a Christian. Then from there he heard that a prophet is going to come. Christianity did not satisfy him, the Christianity of the time. So he migrated to Medina, waiting for that prophecy to come true. And eventually, of course, he met the prophet. We have one hadith from Ayyam alayhi wasalam who says, Salman minna Ahlul Bayt. Salman is from us, from Ahlul Bayt. This shows that here, when we talk about spiritual ranks, blood relation is not important. There is a verse in the Quran when Ibrahim prays to Allah. It's very interesting. He doesn't supplicate, pray for his children. He prays for whoever follows him. And of course, when he prays for his children, those who follow him. He says, وَمَنْ فَمَنْ تَبِعَنِي فَإِنَّهُ مَنِّي. Whoever follows me is from me, is from my family. If we follow Ibrahim, we are from family of Ibrahim. If we do not follow Ibrahim, no matter how close we are to him biologically, in terms of descendants, it doesn't help. The same thing with Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The closeness, the biological closeness, doesn't make people important. Now you may say, so why family of the Prophet are so important? Why his close relatives? Why Ahlul Bayt? No, it happened that way, that these people became his Ahlul Bayt in the sense, in the spiritual sense. You know, Ahlul Bayt of a person, his wives are his Ahlul Bayt, his uncles are his Ahlul Bayt, all his children are his Ahlul Bayt. So Ahlul Bayt has a very sort of extended meaning. However, Prophet himself, just like Ibrahim, said, "Man tabi'ani fa'innahu minni." Whoever follows me is from me. The Prophet himself defined who is my Ahlul Bayt. Those four he chose and said, "Allahumma ha'ulai Ahlul Bayti." These are my Ahlul Bayt. No one else. Umm Salama, his wife. I mean, I know some persons as wives of the Prophet are controversial. Historically. However, there are some wives of the Prophet, like Khadija, some like Umm Salama, there is no controversy about them. Very highly honorable ladies. However, they did not become part of Prophet's Ahlul Bayt. Because Ahlul Bayt here has a very, very restricted meaning. Now, Nuh alayhi salam, for example, had a son, a pervert son. And when Allah promised that you and your Ahlul Bayt will be saved, but his son was drawn in the flood, he was confused. قَالَ رَبِّ إِنَّ إِبْنِي مِنْ أَهْلِي. Well, my son certainly is from my family. وَإِنَّ وَعْدَكَ الْحَقِّ And you promised me that my family will be saved. So, وَأَنْتَ أَحْكَمُ الْحَاكِمِينَ I'm not objecting, I'm asking. I want to know what happened. قَالَ إِنَّهُ لَيْسَ مِنْ أَحْلِكَ No, he is not from your Ahlul Bayt. The Jews, at the time of the Prophet, they were claiming, they had claim on Abraham. That we are descendants of Abraham. We are purely descendants of Abraham. Not like you, for example, the descendants of Ismail who have mixed blood and something like that. Then, of course, the Quran said, "Inna awla an-nas bi Ibrahim." The closer people to Ibrahim are lalladhina taba'uh, those who follow him. Now, when Prophet alayhi salam says, Salman minna ahlul bayt, he's from us, it means he has reached a rank in spirituality, in knowledge, in practice, in humbleness towards God, in what is in his heart, that he could be regarded as one of us, although he's not an imam, but could be regarded in his rank as one of us. Now, someone, this was just off the topic, someone abused Salman very badly, swore at him. Now look at forbearance and tolerance. He said, if my balance on the day of judgment weighs heavy, what you say is not going to hurt me. I don't care what you say. If my balance is going to weigh light, I'm worse than what you say. It's very calm and very rational. It means that what you say is not going to have any effect on me. What is important is who I am in terms of my actions. And this is the case with everyone, in case of their actions. Prophet, peace be on him, had other daughters. But you don't hear about them much. To the extent that some people deny that Prophet had any other daughter than Fatima, peace be on her. Why they are not mentioned? Because although they were very righteous ladies, however, they did not reach that status of Fatima, peace be on her. So, just one hadith and we move on to learn from this hadith. Man karama ghayran. Whoever retains his anger and tolerates the people who anger him. Whoever retains his anger, man karama ghayran wa huwa yaqdiru ala imdha'ih, and he can vent it off. Sometimes we become angry, but we can't do anything because we are helpless, we are powerless. But sometimes we have the power, we have the means, we can retaliate, we can revenge, we can vent off our anger, but we suppress it. Now, whoever does this, hashallahu قَلْبَهُ إِيمَانًا Allah will fill his heart with قَلْبَهُ أَمْنًا وَإِيمَانًا with security, with peace and faith. And this is the case. That's why Amir al-Mu'min said, I never have swallowed anything more pleasurable than my anger. Because when we swallow our anger, something happens inside. We become peaceful. Inside we feel that we are above the people who usually vent their anger. So that was about this. Now coming to Af, what is the difference between forbearance and forgiveness? Forbearance, as I said, is about people who may not necessarily do anything wrong with you, but their ignorance annoys you. So you have to be tolerant. Now, forgiveness is when someone actually wrongs you, does something wrong. Then, of course, the most important standard of behavior according to Islam is forgiveness. It is the standard. خُذِ الْعَافِ Adopt the policy of forgiving. This in Surah Araf, this verse in Surah Araf. خُذِ الْعَافِ Adopt the policy of forgiving. Some people say that Christianity is the religion of forgiveness, Islam is religion of revenge. By no means, Christianity and Islam come from the same source. They cannot be different. They are both the religion of forgiveness, and of course, when times come that they have to stand for justice, both of them stand for justice. Every human being should think about that. But the basic standard of behavior is forgiveness. خذ العاف وأمر بالعرف وأعرض عن الجاهلين. Adopt the policy of forgiving. Bid to good all the time. Anything happens, you try to find the best way for your behavior and turn away from the ignorant. The ignorant people may do things wrong to you. You turn away, you do not care about it. What's the meaning of this? This is a very important verse, and I want to mention a story about Imam Hussein alayhi salam with regards to this verse. However, what is the meaning of this verse? Up to what point we have to forgive? Because sometimes we think forgiving would make people bold. And if we forgive too much, we may bolden them. Now, of course, if things in society happen like that, then forgiveness goes away, law comes in, and people should be stopped from bullying others. But amongst ourselves, how much we have to forgive? How many times? My sister, our sisters, our brothers, our children, our parents, our friends, they wrong us. How much we should forgive? Someone actually asked this question from Jesus, peace be upon him. He said, how much? To what extent? And Isa alayhi salam said, to the extent that you expect God to forgive you. You know, we always want God to forgive us. No matter how many sins we do, how much bold we are, we would like God to forgive us. And he said, like that. There is no limit for that. When this verse was revealed, this is a hadith from Ikrama, something similar we have in our traditions, but with a different spin. He says that Lamma nazalat hadhihi al-ayah, when this verse was revealed, the Prophet asked explanation for it from Jibreel. Qala ya Jibreel, ماذا? What does this mean? What's the meaning of this خذ العاف? It means when I want to practice it, how I have to manifest this value in myself. Jibreel said, قال يا محمد صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم إن ربك يقول, that your Lord says, the meaning of this verse is this, أن تصل من قطعك وتؤتي من حرمك وتعفو عن من ظلمك. Those who cut off with you, those relatives, friends who cut off with you, you join with them. Do not retaliate. Do not let it go long. You join. You go first. No matter if they think that you need them or you have given in or whatever. You do. This is the higher ground in morality, isn't it? Although it's not the higher ground in selfishness and arrogance and other human opposite of merit, demerits, but it is high ground in morality. And tasala man qata'ak wa tu'tiya man haramak. Whoever deprives you, does not give you, you give them. Wa ta'fu an man dhalamak. Whoever wrongs you, you forgive them. This is the meaning of khudh al-'af wa amur bil-'urf. Now, there is one tradition says that on the day of judgment, إذا كان يوم القيامة, when Allah gathers everyone, you know, we don't go to paradise all of us together. Some of us go very quickly, very quickly. As soon as we are raised, as the Prophet, peace be on him, says, just like the time of two rak'ah salat, and we are told, oh, this is paradise, going. Okay. For some of us, it takes very long, 50,000 years. God forbid. It is a torture if we are going to take 50,000 years to go in. And of course, the good thing about poverty, we talked about poverty before, the good thing about poverty is that the poor people go to paradise before the rich people. To compensate for it, isn't it? In this world, 60, 70 years they were rich, we were poor, for example. There, okay, you stay 1,000 years, I will go first. I'll go to paradise first. That's why the Sermon on the Mount, I love this Sermon on the Mount in the Bible. Beautiful. It is original. It cannot be unoriginal. Tuba lil fuqara. Lucky are the poor, because they are the first to enter paradise. That's true. They are the first to enter paradise because they have been somehow downtrodden here and they will be compensated for that. So we don't go all together to paradise. Some go first, some go after. When people are there, yunadi munadin, an angel would call, Aina ahlul fadl? Who are the people of merit? Stand! And of course, no one can lie there. There's no lying. When people of merit should stand, people of merit should stand. Aina ahlul fadl? Where are the people of merit? So a group of people would stand up, and the angels would come and say, okay, what were your merits? In the world, what were your merits? Your merits. They say, kunna nasalu man qata'ana. Whoever cut off relation with us, we joined with them. Wa nu'tiya man haramana. Whoever deprived us, we gave them. Wa na'fu amman dhalamana. This was our habit, kunna. We used to do this. And whoever wronged us, we forgave them. They say, you are really people of merit. Go. Do not stand here. Do not wait here. Other people should wait, but you go first. So there, the importance which is given to this concept of forgiveness in Islam is by no means less than the importance given to forgiveness, the concept of forgiveness in Christianity, but I say it is even more. The problem is that sometimes we misinterpret our faith, or our behavior misinterprets what we believe in. Now, one thing about, I said, I want to tell a story of Imam Hussein alayhi salam in this regard. You know, Imam Hussein was living in Medina after, of course, Muawiyah came to power, and Imam Hassan alayhi salam was driven away from caliphate. They came to Medina, they settled there, until, of course, Imam Hassan alayhi salam passed away. Then Imam Hussein continued to live in Medina in peace until Yazid became caliph. Until that time, Imam did not want to, of course, object or challenge the authority. Now, people of Sham in Syria, they had a very distorted view about the family of Ali, especially Ahlul Bayt, and especially the family of Ali. A man from Sham comes to Medina, goes to Hajj, and comes to Medina to visit the shrine of the Prophet. And then, of course, he had heard very bad thing about Hussein ibn Ali. This is when Imam Hassan had passed away, certainly. This is after the year 50. Now, had heard very bad things about Hussein ibn Ali. He's the most evil person on the earth. He doesn't pray. He doesn't fast. This, you know how the media work. And the media at that time in Syria was worse than the media that we have now. So he came to Medina. He saw people have great respect for Hussein ibn Ali. Wow, how come this evil person, why people respect him so much? And wherever he goes, people gather around him, ask questions, and he sits in the mosque. He talks to the people about religion, about Quran, about faith. So he became very angry. This prejudice, he could not tolerate this. That how this evil person is so much respected by people here. And of course, it was time of Banu Umayyah. They could do whatever they wanted. They could say whatever they wanted. So once Imam Hussein alayhi salam was talking in the mosque, he was sitting as well. And he interrupted the Imam while he was talking. And he said, are you the son of Abu Turab? I mean, Amir al-Mu'mineen. Abu Turab, of course, for Ali, Abu Turab was a very dignified sort of nickname, but Muawiyah was using that to say that he was just like dust, like soul, nothing. So in Sham, they called him Abu Turab. Said, are you the son of Abu Turab? He said, yes. This Assam, his name was Assam ibn Mustalaq. This Assam said, I started to swear at him and his father. And of course, no one could say anything to this man. I started to swear at him and his father. All the things I had heard in Sham, in Syria, I said. فَنَظَرَ إِلَيَّ This is the account he gives. فَنَظَرَ إِلَيَّ نَظْرَةَ عَاطِفٍ رَؤُوفٍ He looked at me. He threw a very kind glance at me, as if my anger was coming from a source which was annoying me, looked at me with kindness and said, Khafiz alayk, take it easy, my brother. Khafiz alayk, why are you so angry? Khafiz alayk, استغفر الله لي ولك or استغفر الله لي ولك. I ask forgiveness for myself and for you, or you ask forgiveness for you and for myself, if I'm like that. And then he said, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم خذ العاف وأمر بالعرف وأعرض عن الجاهلين Adopt the policy of forgiveness. Always advise the good and turn away from jahilin. Where are you from? I haven't seen you here before. You are a stranger. He said, I have come from Syria. He said, okay, that's why. I understand why you are like this. Shenshinatun a'rifuha min akhdam. I know this type of mindset comes from there. But don't worry, if you need anything in this city, my house, everyone knows where it is. You can come to my house if you need money, anything. Because I know that people who come to travel, they may have some shortcomings. This Assam says, I just wanted to melt and go down into the earth, seeing this sort of encounter. And then he says, after that, I came out from the majlis and I didn't go to meet Hussein because I was ashamed of what I did. I just went back. And after that, if anyone said anything bad about Ali and his children, I would have become angry. I love them now very much. You see how the way we treat and behave people is important. Of course, this sort of behavior is very difficult, isn't it? وَمَا يُلَقَّاهَا إِلَّا الَّذِينَ صَبَرُوا Only those with great patience can have this sort of behavior. Okay, the third thing. So, af for حلم, af forbearance, forgiveness, تواضع, humbleness. The third thing, we have one, humbleness towards God and humbleness towards people. Both of them are very important. When a person finds higher ranks with God, they become humbler and humbler. They find more humility in themselves. Why? Because if you do not know God, you cannot compare yourself with Him, isn't it? When you get a knowledge of God, then you can compare yourself and you see how insignificant you are. Someone asked Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, you were in Medina, your father passed away in Tus. How did you know that you became Imam? What happened to you? I mean, internally, psychologically or spiritually, what happened to you? How did you realize that you had become an Imam now? The knowledge, of course, is a very important thing. But he said, I found in myself, in my heart, a sort of humility that I had not experienced before. That means my knowledge increased. The more we have knowledge, the more humiliated towards God we feel, and the more humble. And that humbleness would actually translate to our interaction with people. So if our worship makes us arrogant and we look down at other people, it means that we are on the wrong path. Oh, I pray, I fast, and these people just miss their prayers, miss their morning prayers. If this is our attitude, then we are on the wrong path. The more, the closer we go to God, humbler we would become towards Him and towards others. The more Allah gives us, the humbler we should become, isn't it? Because we should become more appreciative, more thankful. Now, sometimes they say, that man is a scientist, still he worships God. Oh, if he is a scientist, God has blessed him with knowledge. So he should be more thankful. Why you say, although he is a scientist, although he is a doctor, although he is an engineer, he worships God or he prays? Well, this is a wrong sort of attitude that we have. You know, this Najashi, the king of Abyssinia, when the Prophet sent Muslims there, of course, Prophet had some knowledge. He wouldn't have just ventured sending Muslims to Abyssinia, to a Christian country, saying that you go there and see what happens. After they were under torture, he said, go there, there is a just king there. Go and seek refuge with him. They went, and when, of course, he asked about religion of Ja'far ibn Abi Talib. Ja'far ibn Abi Talib was leading the group to Abyssinia. He recited verses of the Quran for him. He started to cry. And this is what is mentioned in Surah Ma'idah. وَإِذَا سَمِعُوا مَا أُنزِلَ عَلَى الرَّسُولِ تَرَى أَعْيُنُهُمْ تَفِيضُ مِنَ الدَّامِ مِمَّا عَرَفُوا مِنَ الْحَقِّ. When what is revealed to the Prophet, to the Messenger, is recited for them, because they didn't hear it directly. When it is recited for them, and when they hear it, you see their eyes flows with tears. This was, and he believed, of course, Najashi believed. He was one man. He couldn't convince his people to believe as well. He kept his belief, of course, hidden from his people. Ja'far ibn Abu Talib says that once I went to... Najashi actually called me. When we were there, of course, Najashi was the king, and these were refugees there under the auspicious of Najashi. He called me. I went to his palace. Usually I used to meet him, of course, in the main court of the palace with lots of luxuries and these things. This time, the guard took me to a very convoluted way and we went to a very small room. And he ushered me to the room. I saw Najashi has worn a threadbare dress, sitting on the ground underneath soil and dust and sitting there and saying dhikr. I was amazed. I said, what has happened? I thought to myself, something enormous should have happened now that to this country, that we have come to this country and something has happened. Najashi is actually having this sort of crying for what has happened now in the country. He told me, don't worry, come and sit. I went and sat. He said, you know what has happened? I said, no. He said, my spies have brought me news that in such and such date, in such and such place called Badr, your prophet defeated his enemies. And such people were killed. Of course, he was king, he had the spies and all these things. And I wanted to give you this news, this good news. He said, okay, if this is the good news, why are you sitting like this here? Why on the soil? Why this dress? He said, you know, our religion has taught us, whenever God gives us a new bounty, a new ni'mah, when he renews his blessing to us, we have to renew our humbleness to him. Appreciation. Appreciate. To come back to see, to come back to ourselves and see that we are no one. Why God did give blessing to us? So I am doing this as a gesture of thanks and appreciation to God, to show that I'm no one, but you have blessed us with such a victory. Now you see, this king in Abyssinia regards the victory of Bad as his own victory and is thanking Allah for it. So this humbleness towards God, of course, brings humbleness towards people as well. And this is one of the most important things that we have to, in our relation to people, we have to bear in mind that as soon as we feel we are a bit above others, we have actually betrayed ourselves. Imam Reza alayhi salam gives 10 advice to one of his followers and says, and then says, the 10th one, what is the 10th one? And how can you practice the 10th one? He says, what's the 10th one? He says, whoever you see in this world, you think that you are lower than him. Oh, what about the disbelievers? What about the people who, what about the criminals? He said, even though you say maybe they have something good in themselves that God would save them eventually, and maybe I have something bad in myself which is not apparent now, which would lead me to perdition eventually. You know, what is important at the end of the day is not here. What is important is the balance there. How that balance works, we don't know. So we have to be humble. قال رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم ما لي لا أرى عليكم حلاوة العبادة. Why I do not see on you the sweetness of worship. You worship, but it's a burden. You worship, but it's not sweet. You worship, but it's not tasty for you. Why I don't see that? They say, وَمَا حَلَاوَةُ الْعِبَادَةِ. They say, Ya Rasulullah, this is a new concept. For food, we know there is sweetness, there is taste. But the taste of ibadah, what's the taste of ibadah? He said, التَّوَاضُع. If you show tawadu, humbleness, it means that you are feeling the taste of ibadah and worship in your heart. It, of course, we cannot pretend tawadu. Tawadu would come with, it has many sort of factors which would lead us to become humble to God, to people. But we have to somehow try to bring about all those conditions which makes us. And you know why we are not humble usually? Why we are arrogant? Why we try to show to others that we are above them? Because we feel a sort of smallness in ourselves. We feel shortcomings. And we want always to tell others that we are above you. If we are above others, why should we tell them? Why should we pretend, be pretentious about it? Why? So that's why this hadith from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq says, مَا مِنْ أَحَدٌ تَكَبَّرَ أَوْ تَجَبَّرَ. No one shows arrogance or shows imposing his will over others, إِلَّا لَذِلَّةٍ وَجَدَهَا فِي نَفْسِهِ, but because of a humiliation that he feels inside. Not that humiliation which is good, a humiliation which is bad, which is not dignified. Now, would anyone enter paradise with arrogance? No. Impossible. So would any of us would go to paradise? Because all of us have arrogance, isn't it? All of us have arrogance. We cannot deny that. Would anyone of us go to paradise? Yes, inshallah, all of us would go to paradise. So how? How do you solve this paradox? Ma la yadkhulul jannah, qala rasulullah. لا يدخل الجنة من كان في قلبه مثقال حبة من خردل من كبر. If the weight of an the mustard seed, you have arrogance in your heart, you would not enter paradise. Why? Because you know when we go to paradise, our free will exponentially increases. We become godlike in our free will. Our power exponentially increases. And you can imagine someone with arrogance, what hell can make in paradise for others. Yes, of course, the paradise will go. They say this hell is a mercy of God. Isn't you have you heard this? That hell is a mercy of God. How hell is a mercy of God? Hell is not mercy of God for those who are inside it. It's a mercy of God for those who are outside it. Because those people are kept there so that they could not disturb others. They could not destroy the whole paradise. So no one would enter paradise with a mustard seed, weight of mustard seed arrogance in the heart. So what happens? We go through different processes until the final judgment so that this will go out of our heart. And eventually the final touch of Allah, وَنَزَعَنَا مَا فِي صُدُورُهِمْ مِنْ غِلٍّ. In Surah A'raf says, when the companions of paradise come to the gates, they wait there. They have to wait there. They have to wait there until we bring out from their hearts things which do not conform with the life in paradise. وَنَزَعْنَا مَا فِي صُدُورِهِمْ مِنْ غِلٍّ تَجْرِي مِنْ تَحْتِهِمُ الْأَنْهَارِ. The rivers of paradise are coming towards them. They are just on the gates. But because then they said, لَمْ يَدْخُلُوهَا وَهُمْ يَطْمَعُونَ. They haven't yet entered. But they have the hope to enter paradise. But we have, before that, we have to take this out. Now, sometimes taking this paradise out of the heart would be very hard. And that's why in one hadith we have that إِنَّ الْمُتَكَبِّرُونَ يُجْعَلُونَ فِي صُوَرِ الذَّرِّ يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ حَتَّى يَفْرُغَ اللَّهُ مِنْ الْحِسَابِ. The mutakabbirun will be made in the form of ants, small ants, people trampling upon them on the day of judgment. They become very small compared to others. And you can imagine when you are very small compared to others and they actually walk upon you, you have to run away from their steps, how humiliated you feel. Now, this is to bring this arrogance out of their hearts. It works. Inshallah, we wouldn't be like that. When we are raised, inshallah, we wouldn't be like that. But it works. It was all these things which are set there is to prepare us eventually to go to paradise. And when I say paradise, don't think that it's a garden that we just go there. No. We have no concept in this world which could define paradise. Whatever is given for us is just example. مَثَلُ الْجَنَّةِ الَّتِي وَعِدَ الْمُتَّقُونَ. The example of paradise is like this, أُكُلُهَا دَائِمْ. Like if you are always eating and sort of enjoying that eating. Well, if we always eat, we die, isn't it? It's just like this example of it. When you eat, you enjoy it, but you can't eat more than 15 minutes, isn't it? But it's like this, contemplate a place where you are always continuously eating. You have that enjoyment of eating. Example, it's not like that, of course, in paradise we are not always eating, but the example I bit. أُكُلُهَا دَائِمٌ وَذَلُّهَا تِلْكَ أُقْبَى الَّذِينَ اتَّقَوْا. Anyhow, so let's make ourselves humble in this world, so that there we are not made in the form of ants and people trampling upon us. Let's make it here. Everything is easy to make here, difficult to make there. There things would be very difficult to change. Here, one night Ya Allah, forgive me, he would forgive. Of course, with the resolve that I'm not going to do these things again. And this is why the scholars of morality and akhlaq all the time are advising us to things which are not very much favorable to us in this world. Let me give you one story from Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. Once a Hajj group came from another city, passing by Medina, going to Mecca. And of course, these Hajj groups, which came from other cities, they didn't know who's who in Medina. They just went and visited the shrine of the Prophet and went for Hajj. Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam asked this group, "Would you take me with you as well?" He said, "Yes, of course, you can come with us. You pay this amount and you come with us." He said, "Okay." So he joined that caravan and he was serving there, serving the Hujjaj, preparing their food. If someone needed something, just help them. Until they reached a village on the way, and one man recognized him, that this is Zainul Abidin Ali ibn Hussein. And amazed, why this man, why Ali ibn Hussein is serving these people, these strangers? So he went to the head of the group and said, "Do you know who this man is who's serving you?" He said, "It was a young man joined us in Medina and came with us." He said, "This is Ali ibn Hussein. This is the grandson of the Prophet." Everyone was terrified. "Wow, Ali ibn Hussein was serving us. God saved us. We didn't swear at him. We didn't say anything wrong." So they went kissing his hand. "Please forgive us. Please remember us in your du'as. Why didn't you tell us? We may have abused you or something." Imam said to that man, "Why did you tell them who am I? I had joined them so that they don't know me. I could serve them. If I go with any group from Medina, they respect me. This is the grandson of the Prophet. The best food, the best everything they bring for me. I wanted to serve them." This is humbleness. This is humbleness. This is how we have to practice these things. Now, we go to Hajj with a group. Oh. I'm the Maulana, isn't it? The best place, the best food, the best table, everything. This is what we have to learn from our A'imma alayhimus salam. So the other thing was tawadu. One knows wishing well for people. Oh, wishing well for people is very difficult, isn't it? Jealousy doesn't allow that. If people have something good, we become jealous. And we don't wish well for them. God save us, we do not somehow express our jealousy by our action to do something which harm other people. You know, jealousy is very bad. But the scholars say that if you are jealous, but you keep it to yourself, you don't do anything, you don't express it, you're not punished for it. I mean, God would not punish you for it, but you punish yourself, isn't it? If you are jealous, we punish ourselves. We are always, "Oh, why they have, we don't have. Why this man, why this woman have these things, we don't have it." This jealousy would, of course, inside would burn us. However, if we express it outside with an act which would hurt the others, this would become a great sin, and there is punishment for it. Now, why we cannot wish well for other people? One cause is jealousy. There are other causes, probably. But in our interaction with other, يَجِبُ لِلْمُؤْمِنِ عَلَى الْمُؤْمِنِ النَّصِيحَةِ لَهُ فِي الْمَشْهَدِ وَالْمَغِيبِ. A mu'min should always wish well for another mu'min, whether they are present or not present. Wishing well for others. I want to tell another story. Just let me go through this hadith. إِنَّ أَعْظَمَ النَّاسِ مَنْزِلَةً يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ. The greatest people in terms of their position in the Day of Judgment, أَمْشَاهُمْ فِي أَرْضِهِ بِالنَّسِيحَةِ لِخَلْقِهِ. Those who try on this earth to bring good for others, all the time, to bring good for others. This is the people with the highest position. Now, you see, the interesting thing about all these things, when we talk about our relation with God, you think that this is the most important thing. We only have to correct our relation with God. When we talked about our relation with ourselves, we thought that this is the most important. We have only to correct our relation with ourselves. And when we come to relation with people, we say, oh, this is very important. So all of these aspects are important. We cannot damage our relation with God at the expense of our relation with people, or vice versa. They are complementary. They complete each other. Once Prophet, peace be on him, was sitting in the mosque, and he said, now a man comes in who is one of the inhabitants of paradise. And Ashab just waited to see who comes in. And an old man, they didn't know, I was living some in the suburbs of Medina, came in. You're amazed why this man is one inhabitant of paradise. Why not us? We are always with the prophets and here in the mosque, and we don't see him here in the mosque very much. So he went, and again, after a while, the prophet said, today a man enters this mosque who's one of the inhabitants of paradise. And again, the same man came in. Yeah, people are amazed. For the third time, Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-As. Amr ibn al-As, the of course, famous cohort of Muawiyah. He had a son, Abdullah, who was a scholar. At that time, he was very young. He says, I became curious. I became curious to see what this man has. So I arranged a plan with myself. After he left, I went to him and told him, can I come and stay with you for a couple of nights? He said, why? I said, you know, I have some quarrel with my father. He doesn't let me go in to my house. So he said a lie to find out why this man is one of the inhabitants of paradise. He said, okay, come, I'm alone in my house. So they went, they walked to his house. He stayed there watching very carefully what this man does. And he saw a very ordinary man, just like any other person. He didn't wait for Salatul Layl. Just in the morning, he woke up, he did his Salat, the morning prayer, and then he went to work and came back. Not any extra zek, not any extra thing. First day, second day, third day. And on third day, he said, you know, I'm amazed. And I really doubted if Prophet was telling the truth or not, or is he not mistaken? Because the way you behave is very ordinary. Why Prophet says you are from people of paradise, while we are trying a lot, and Prophet doesn't say that about us? He said, I don't know, but this is my life. I always live like this. I just do whatever is obligatory for me and work. I was a poor man. Abdullah went, while he was going, the man said, maybe there is one thing, let me tell you. Now, because you are a very curious young man, let me tell you. You know, I never feel jealous in my heart about what other people have. Never. Now, this man was telling the truth, of course, there was no reason why he should tell lies. And also, I always wish well for everyone. And this is why the Prophet said this is a person, an inhabitant of paradise. Sometimes we think religion is only about worshipping God, while religion is actually about all aspects of our life. All aspects of our life. I know people who always pray in the first line in the mosque. They never miss, always in Dua Qubayl. I can swear they go to hell I can swear to you, they go to hell. No, really. No, I know a particular person. No, I'm not talking generally, of course. No, no. Anyone who prays in the first line would go to hell. No, no. I'm talking about one particular man, okay? I can swear he goes to hell because the way he behaves with people. Well, religion is not only about worshiping in the first line of Salat. Anyhow, so the fifth thing was An-Nusr, and after that is Shafaqa, which inshallah I leave it for tomorrow night. Ash-Shafaqa, compassion, Al-Insaf, justice, Wal-Adl, Al-Insaf, equity, Wal-Adl, justice. Inshallah we talk about it tomorrow night. Now, send the salawat and inshallah we'll talk about Hussein alayhi salam. Sayyid ibn Tawus, you probably have heard of him, the very greatest scholar at the time of the Mongol attack on Muslim lands. He was in Hella and one of those people who actually saved the city by the good policy that they adopted. One of them, of course, not only him. He has written many books. One maqtal he has written, a very short, concise maqtal, but very beautifully worded. One of the best expressions that he has is about when Hussein alayhi salam is left without anyone, is now alone. You know, in Karbala, those who were killed in the morning, they were the luckiest because they didn't see others being killed. The most painful tragedy was for Hussein alayhi salam, who saw everyone to be killed in front of his eyes. He had to go through that pain. I don't think anyone had that sort of tolerance or endurance to go through all that pain. From the morning to the noon, he saw everyone in front of his eyes. Now he says, Falamma رَأَى الْحُسَيْنِ مَصَارَعَ فِتْيَانِهِ وَأَحِبَّتِهِ. When Hussein saw that all his children and all his loved ones were killed, everyone now is dead. نَادَى بِأَعْلَى صَوْتِهِ. He called. He went in front of the camp of Kufa and called. أَلَا مِنْ ذَابٍ يَضُبُّ أَنْ حَرَمِ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ. Isn't there anyone to protect the children and women of prophets? Because now there are children and women there only. And inshallah, in the day of Ashura, when we recite Maqtal, we would say, the greatest concern of Imam Hussein was what will happen to them after him. This was the greatest concern. So when he was alone, he called out, أَلَا مِنْ ذَابٍ يَضُبُّ عَنْ حَرَمِ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ. Isn't there anyone to come and protect the haram of the Prophet? أَلَا مِنْ مُوَحِّدٍ يَخَافُ اللَّهَ فِينَا. Isn't there any believer who fears God regarding us? We are the family of the Prophet. There's no one. And of course, as he was talking to rocks, nothing came back. So he decided now it was his turn to go and fight. Just one thing. One final thing he had to do. And he had a 6-month-old son that he loved a lot. And he wanted to bid farewell. So before going to the battlefield, he came back to the tent and said, Ya Zainab, nawalini waladi as-saghir hatta awaddah. Give me my little boy so that I bid farewell to him. Now, this boy, you can imagine when he was given to Hussein alayhi salam, thirsty, probably not being able to even cry from the thirst and hunger which had somehow fallen on him. And there are two accounts. One account which Sheikh Mufid mentions is this. So he brought the baby up to kiss him. But before his lips reaching the cheek of the boy, the arrow of Harmala hit his throat. Now Zainab was standing there. And immediately Zainab took the boy from Hussein, knowing that what happens to this father, devastating, isn't it? It's devastating. I don't know why Hussein had to go through all these. Why he had to go through all these. So at that moment, probably, he didn't know what to do. The blood was gushing out. So he just put his hand on the throat to probably keep the blood, and his hand was filled with the blood. It was, of course, not helping, isn't it? So he threw the blood to the sky and said, "Hawwana alayya ma nazala bi annahu bi'ayni Allah." What makes all these easy for me is that God is watching. It's happening before his eyes. And then he said, "O God, if you have wished not to help us here, I submit to you because I know there is a higher purpose for it." This is the man of faith. And of course there was the higher purpose. We are here today talking about God because of Hussein. That is the higher purpose. وَلَا حَوْلَ وَلَا قُوَّةَ إِلَّا بِاللَّهِ الْعَلِيِّ الْعَظِيمِ.
Question and answer. Comments with regards to this evening's deliverance or the deliverance in these nights? Any questions? Comments? Yes, sir. So, mic there, please. He's come prepared. You can see he's written it down. He's got a prescription. That's what doctors do.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum.
I just want to bring up the issues that we talked about yesterday. Following up on yesterday's discussion, I would like to make it absolutely clear that my question was intended for my better understanding of Islam. I'm not a blind follower of Islam, as I strive to seek answers for my own benefit, regardless of the methodology I use. If my questioning were perceived otherwise, then I'd rather be a shaitan who seeks knowledge and inspiration by questioning for a better understanding of Allah than a pious, silent man. For my understanding, the Quran talks about primarily characters of shaitan as someone who has no power other than the power to cast evil suggestions into humans. We made the evil ones friendly only to those without faith. Then I must turn to faith. What is faith and how we define it? For most of us, faith has resulted from our parental inheritance. In some, this would be within the context of Islam, and others within the context of other religions. Some try to understand better by inquiring and having inquisitive minds. Others are followers by religious faith from what they've inherited. Many Adams have learned things in an unconventional way, but at least we learn and understand, rather than just accept things at their face value for fear of social stigma. It is through questioning and seeking the knowledge and trying to acquire comfortable position within oneself that makes us good human beings. Mere blind acceptance should not be the norm. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
Asant.
So what was the question?
Thank you very much. I don't know, no one perceived what you said any other way. I mean, Did anyone perceive what he said in another way? I mean, it was a very healthy discussion we had, and whatever you said, of course, I really acknowledge and agree with you. Inshallah, Allah will increase our knowledge, all of us, inshallah. Thank you very much. Thank
you. Yes, we're going to microphone back.
Thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam.
I'm a little bit troubled by the weight that we put on doing good and being humble and helping others and not wishing badly on others, because there's a seat in paradise to do it for that gain. Okay, so I want to give you a theoretical example, and then I'll listen to your answer. But let's say there are two men or two people, and one is humble and one gives charity and one does their obligatory prayers and doesn't wish well poorly on other people, only wishes well on other people. And the next man, and that first man does it just because it's the right thing to do. It. He knows in his heart it's the right thing to do. The next man does it because he thinks, if I do these things, I will have a seat in paradise. And let's say there's a bus going to paradise with only one seat left. Which one of those two men gets the seat?
Alhamdulillah, there are plenty of seats there in the bus, so you don't need to worry. Thank you so much. Thank you. Why do you limit the seats in the bus going to paradise? Inshallah, both of them will go to paradise.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam.
Yesterday you mentioned that all humans are blessed with the Spirit of God inside of us. And we talk about Nabi Isa being blessed with Ruhul Qudus. So what's the difference and what's the significance of that?
Ruh is a very complicated thing for us to understand. And that's why in Surah Isra we have, when they ask the Prophet about Ruh, he says, يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الْرُوحِ قُلَ الْرُوحُ مِنْ أَمْرِ رَبِّي. Say, Ruh is from the affairs of my Lord. That means it's not something which is could be understood in this world of matter of us. وَمَا أُوتِيتُم مِنَ الْعِلْمِ إِلَّا قَلِيلًا. You are not given knowledge but a little bit about Ruh. There is a difference between Ruh and Nafs. Nafs is, of course, is what all of us have, which manages our body. And the Ruh is, the Nafs is graded. For example, we have Nafs in plants as well, which makes them to grow, move. We have Nafs in animals, which makes them to judge, to even, for example, decide where to go, where not to go. Then we have that nafs in human beings, which would urge them to have a social life. These are different levels of, or different manifestations of nafs or ruh, if we use them interchangeably, in different things. So that nafs or ruh cannot manifest itself in a plant more than it is. It cannot manifest itself in an animal more than that, which they have. In human being, it can manifest itself in a very high grade. Like, for example, we worship God, that ruh would somehow identify with our nafs grows with the ruh, which is connected with God. For the prophets, there is a higher grade of ruh than ordinary human beings. You see, the ruh which is in us, or the nafs which is identified with that ruh, with that we can contemplate, think, judge, know things. It's all through that. Okay, of course we have the means for it, the eyes, ears, mind, everything. But we cannot see things which are related to malakut. We cannot see things which are going to come about in future. We cannot know God. We only have a concept of God, but we don't have a knowledge of God. that higher degree of Ruh, which is called Ruhul Qudus, when it manifests itself, and when a person has the capacity to be manifested in it, that Ruh, he knows things that other human beings don't know. For example, first of all, he can receive revelation. Without that Ruh, it's impossible for a person to receive revelation. And this is what we have in Surah Mu'min, يُلْقَ الرُّوحَ مِنْ أَمْرِهِ, that Ruh which is from his affair, he throws it, عَلَى مَنْ يَشَاءُ مِنْ عَبَادِهِ, to whoever of his servants he wishes, لِيُنْذَرَ يَوْمَ التَّلَاقِ, then he becomes a warner, then he receives revelation. With that Ruh, a person can know things which belongs to Akhirah. Because knowledge comes to man through Ruh. I mean, even the knowledge that we have comes to us through Ruh. And that higher knowledge of prophets comes through Ruhul Qudus. So they have a higher rank of Ruh. They're connected with Ruhul Qudus. And that's why they know things that we don't know it. This is the meaning of it.
We have a question here.
I think we are very fortunate to have you here, and I also thank our committee for having invited you, and hope we'll have more opportunities of coming.
Thank you. My pleasure.
My question is the writers of the two authors, which differs in this instance. Now, this is an Arabic word. I don't know whether I'll be pronouncing correctly. Myth of Garanik. Garanik can, or satanic worships.
Garanik. Myth of Garanik, yes.
I know exactly what happened, where it happened, in Khane Kaaba, in Mecca. And then I was referring to synopsis of Aga Mendipuya, who says, when Prophet amongst the Quraysh, he was reciting Surah Najm, and when he came to Ayah 19 and 20, at that time a pagan who said a sentence, and that was, lofty idols, intercession is necessary. This is, and the same thing when I read the synopsis of Ayatollah Jafar Subhani, I don't know, you know this.
Okay. Yeah.
His word was totally different. When Prophet came to this, was reciting Surah Najm amongst Qurayshi, tribe of Qurayshis. All Qurayshis were around, who were, I'm sure, were pursuing Prophet to leave the three gods, namely Lat, Uzza, and Manat. I think they were very favorite gods of theirs. And I'm sure at that time, this is my thinking, that Prophet must have been embarking of removing all those gods from Khane Kaaba. And these people are requesting him not to touch these three. Now, at that time, Prophet went to Sijda and he was disturbed by Shaitan. And then when he came up, and this is what he, this is the what Prophet said. They are beautiful, high-ranking bird, and their anticipation is anticipated. So my question is this: in other, there are so many verses of Quran where Allah upholds Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So I don't care. I don't think this was just a myth. And what is right and wrong? Was
prophet disturbed by Shaitan, or that was a pagan who said the words.
The question is what? If the prophet was disturbed by Shaitan, or
pagan said the first word. The first time, the synopsis of Ahapuya is that when he was with the tribe of Quraysh,
a pagan said
the sentence.
You want to know which one was that?
Yeah, pagan said the sentence. The meaning was both the same, actually.
Well, this myth of Gharaniq is, of course, discussed in much detail in the books. And I think what our Subhani is saying is not approving it. Our Subhani is actually criticizing it, not saying that the Prophet was disturbed by Shaitan. He mentions this story, which is reported in Tabari, and then criticizes it, that this is one of those made-up traditions to degrade the Prophet. It is against the whole flow of the verses. It's against the context. And it's against, of course, the esma of the Prophet, which we prove from other verses of the Quran. Now, Agapuya may have given it a different spin, saying that what Tabari has reported is not that Prophet himself said these are high-flying birds, that intercession is expected from them. One of the kuffar said that, and then the hadith was mixed up. However, of course, both Sunni and Shi'i scholars have discussed this hadith which Tabari has reported. One of the problems with Tabari was that although he was a great scholar, he was eager to collect anything he heard. And this tradition of gharaniq, that the Prophet made a mistake or Shaitan revealed something to him without him knowing it, is actually crept into his book. This inspired Salman Rushdie. Salman Rushdie wrote his book based on this tradition, and actually in one of his interviews he said that this is in your books. I have written it just, of course, the way he mentioned it, and then he went into the family of the Prophet, wives of the Prophet. It was not only this issue in his book. But these, of course, the scholars are criticizing what Tabari has written. The story is absolutely a myth. It is just a made-up story. And I don't think it's worth discussing it. I mean, it's just discussing something which has no truth in it. We can discuss this later if you wish, inshallah.
Anybody else?
Assalamu alaikum. I really enjoyed the lectures. It was really nice, especially the part which you do the, you know, the connection with the Allah and how it can be. Today you talked about that the, you know, people who go through hardship, they'll go to the paradise first, right? But my question is, because sometimes it's very difficult to reconcile the thought when I see all the sufferings that's happening in the world, like you see everywhere, and especially some nations, some people, they have been going through this suffering for such a long time that sometimes makes me wonder, is it Allah's plan or is it the human folly? And I just want to get that.
You see, thank you very much for the question. Allah has entrusted us with the earth and its blessings. He says to Adam and Eve, go you and your children, this is earth, it belongs to you. Live there. Now, of course, we destroy the earth. We do not distribute the wealth of the earth in the correct way. We oppress others. We employ others in a sort of exploiting way. This is our doing, okay? And Allah does not command this. Allah is not happy with it. However, if we look at it from a different perspective, now, whether it is Allah's plan or people's plan or people's fault, whatever, a child which is born in Africa as a poor person, for example, or in any other, because I know sometimes the Africans tell us that don't always talk about our poverty, talk about our other things as well. We have lots of blessings. We always talk about our poverty. No. I mean, a child who's born in a poor family and is not given the justice that a human being should receive in the society, no matter who is responsible, okay, his life is spent in that. And at the end of the day, Allah is in charge of everything, isn't it? It's our misdeed, but Allah has allowed it. Allah has allowed it, it's our misdeed, but because He has said, you go and do whatever you want. اَعْمَلُوا مَا شَأْتُمْ. Do whatever you want. The only thing that you have to know is that I am watching. And of course, I would make the wrongs right at the end of the day. So, if this is the case, although we are wronged by people, although there is bad distribution of wealth and all these things, it's our fault, but someone is caught in this situation. What is his fault? That's why I say Allah will compensate it for him. We expect him to do it, isn't it? Because he has created him. And he has allowed this situation to go on for a higher purpose. As Imam Hussein alayhi salam said in Karbala, if this is for a higher purpose, I know that your purpose is always above all purpose. So, yes, of course, people who are caught in a situation which is difficult, Allah is going to compensate it for them. There's a very beautiful hadith which says, if a person endures a hardship in this world and they are patient and do not complain, do not complain doesn't mean that you don't make effort to change the situation. In the heart, they don't think that, oh God, you are doing all these things to me. Do not complain. On the day of judgment, I will feel ashamed to set a balance for him or to open his book. Without opening his book, I say, go to paradise. So this is how Allah would compensate for the situation. I don't know whether this addresses your question or not.
Sometimes the natural disasters too, which cannot be attributed to the human being.
Yeah, well, that's even more manifest, isn't it? I mean, natural disasters, okay, some of us should live 50 years, some of us should live 30 years, some more, some less. When natural disasters comes, for example, people who have to die at a certain age die altogether. You know, we have a natural disaster every day. Who knows how many people die, how many children die every day? Who knows that? Anyone has any statistic?
One every 6 seconds.
So how many would be that? Anyhow, say several thousand, okay? Now, if these several thousand people die at one place, ow, why God does that? It's a natural disaster, isn't it? But because they die in different places, we don't see it, we say, well, that's natural, okay? So it is not important, I mean, that people die at the same time or in different times, or for example, poverty comes in a gradual way or in a sudden way. Everything is going to find its meaning, of course, when we go to the higher world, inshallah.
Get the mic over here, please.
Out in the back.
You have a question? Please. Okay.
Yes. Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much for all the information and knowledge that you have provided us.
My honor. Thank you.
But at the same time, I feel very confused. I have never worried about the definition of forgiveness, but I think you've provoked me to think, and I'm not sure what forgiveness means. For example, if Aziz makes my life very difficult and he is being a nuisance.
You are his mother-in-law?
Yeah, I'm talking about him.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that
was. So I put up with him, I tolerate him. I'm not avoiding him, but I'm tolerating him. But I'm not going out of my way to spend time with him. So is that forgiveness if he's really bothered me or hurt me or whatever?
Or does forgiveness mean that I have truly forgiven somebody if I'm available and able to be with that person? That means I have my sanity and I don't have to avoid him. So I just want to know, is there a level like tolerance comes first and then forgiveness comes, or when does forgiveness come?
Well, for Thank this you. Special gentleman, I say you forgive totally.
Awesome. Thank you. I need it.
Okay, yeah. We'll change the guy, not him.
Yeah. Well, you know, the situation, we have to judge ourselves, really. Sometimes forgiveness would embolden a person. You need to show some sort of
in the back. Shabir.
Limit, restraint there. And especially when it comes to social issues. In Surah Shura, there are several verses. It praises those who retaliate and then says, but remember, forgiveness is the norm. And the exegesis explained that, yes, if, for example, socially, if someone does something wrong to you and you do not stop them, they go and do it to another person, and another person, there you have to stop them. But if, of course, it's not the case, the case is not like that, and the person only is doing it to you and not no one else, it doesn't embolden them, then, of course, forgiveness comes first. And sometimes, for example, we think that we have forgiven someone, but our behavior shows that we, in the bottom of our heart, we have not forgiven them. We cannot pray for them, for example. We cannot ask God to bless them. Although we say, okay, we have forgiven you, we have good relations, but in the bottom of our heart, we have not forgiven them. Even that shouldn't be the case. I mean, even from the bottom of our hearts, we have to forgive. As I said, the case should be judged by every individual, every person. There isn't a sort of general rule that we can talk about it.
Sister Mubaraka, trust me, I would never stand here and judge you. Not at all, please.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam.
Today's lecture, you mentioned, you touched upon two things, forgiveness and then also wishing others good, or praying for others. And I've always had difficulty with this one line in Du'a-i Kumail. And pardon me if I do not translate it right, but it goes something like, O Allah, wish him ill who plots against me, who wishes ill against me. If you can elaborate on that.
No, it's man aradani basu'an fa'aridhu. Whoever intends evil to me, I am not going to intend evil. You sort it out for me. You sort it out for me. And this is something which all of us actually need, that if people intend evil for us, we don't worry to always try to somehow unravel their plots and go plot against them. Man aradani bisu'in fa'aratu, I leave it to you. If someone really is doing evil against me and I'm unaware of it or aware of it, I leave it to you. Do whatever is necessary.
Anybody else? Yes.
Assalamu alaikum. My question has got nothing to do with the lecture of today, but my understanding is that nobody keeps the knowledge of future, unless if I'm wrong, with the exception of those chosen ones whom Allah has bestowed this knowledge. Now in the Holy Quran, there are three instances when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is asking Iblis to do the sujood to Adam, Prophet, alayhi salam. And one of the reasons he refuses to do this sujood is that he is saying that how can I do a sujood to those people whose progeny is going to create facade on this earth. How did he have that knowledge?
Okay, very good question. First of all, knowledge of future, I know people who have knowledge of future, very ordinary people. It's sometimes, I mean, as we are different in our intelligent capacity, we are different in our spiritual capacity as well. And without any, not that they are good people, they just have this knowledge ordinarily. They know things, not everything, but certain things. Now, of course, this is a sort of accidental knowledge. This is very vague. Those people who have it sometimes make mistakes about it. But the Quran says, yes, there are some chosen people who are given. Alimul Ghayb, فَلَا يُظْهِرُ عَلَىٰ غَيْبِهِ أَحَدًا. He is the one who possesses the knowledge of Ghayb, and he would not make anyone to know that knowledge, إِلَّا مَنْ اِرْتَضَىٰ مِنْ رَسُولٍ, except a messenger that he is pleased with. Then, of course, he gives him that knowledge. And that's why we believe the knowledge of A'imma is inherited from the prophets. That knowledge has gone through the prophet to him. Take the example of Prophet Khizr and Musa, isn't it? When Musa met Khizr, Khizr knew that this ship is going to, or this boat is going to be confiscated soon, so he broke it. Or this child, when he grows, he's going to do bad to his parents, he removes him by the, of course, command of God. Or the treasure under that wall. Okay, he had that knowledge of future. So it is possible to have knowledge of future. Because Shaitan was living in the world of Malakut with angels. That world, time is very different. For example, when we say future, there are some future which is not known to anyone. There are certain future which is known at a higher level. Like, for example, when we die, we have a knowledge of future that we don't have it in this world. That's why you see, or for example, sometimes we see our deceased relative, they tell us that something is going to happen in future. How do they know it? They have that knowledge, okay? And if they can somehow communicate with us, they tell us that this is going to happen. Shaitan had that knowledge. First of all, he knew that this race, human race, is going to die and resurrect it. And that was why he said, "Anzirni ila yawmi yub'athun," give me respite until they are resurrected. So he knew that. He knew that Adam is going to live on the earth, and he knew that he's going to actually lead many of them astray. Why? Because he was living in that world. Now, in Surah Jinn, for example, we have some jinn say that sometimes the jinn try to penetrate to that Alamul Malakut and listen and learn about future, because things are known there which are not known here. It's very commonplace, it's natural. There it's natural to know these things of future. But if someone can connect to it, and this is why I say, وَإِنَّا كُنَّا نَقْعُدُ مِنْهَا مَقَاعِدَ لِلسَّامِ, we used to find some holes to Malakut. We listened, and we actually learned about the future. فَمَنْ يَسْتَمِعِ, and after the Prophet was appointed, يَجَدْ لَهُ شَهَابًا رَسَدًا, there is an arrow coming and hitting them, if anyone wants to listen. So this is the how Shaitan could know about these things. Is that clear?
Do you think that it is possible there is another star or another planet which is older than the Earth, where they are similar kind of human beings, and who had an Adam too? Or there were many Adams before our Adam we are talking.
It's not impossible. Not impossible. And Avicenna says that everything which hits your ear, put it in the realm of possibility. It's possible. Maybe. Yeah. Maybe.
Okay. Anybody else? Here. Or you get the mic over here, please.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam.
I think yesterday you quoted a hadith, if I'm not mistaken, where Nabi Isa was asking if Allah could possibly forgive Shaitan.
Abi Isa.
Yeah. And he said, yes, if he repents. So I was pondering on this, and my question is how do we balance this concept of forgiveness with the concept of justice of Allah? Because even if you take it down to the human level, if you commit crimes against other humans, and you really truly do repent, I mean, how does that forgiveness stack up against justice of Allah, justice for other human beings?
Yeah, the crimes which are done against other human beings or other creatures, even against animals, is not forgiven until those creatures give their agreement that yes, this could be forgiven. And sometimes it is the case that when we go for judgment, this is how the extent of mercy of God. When we go for judgment, for example, I have wronged you and you want justice. Now Allah would tell you, we have this in Hadith, would tell you how much I give you to forgive. What do you want? And our, of course, imagination is limited. Then Allah himself suggests 4 palaces in that grade of paradise. Would it satisfy you? Would you forgive? If you forgive, of course, both of you go and Allah would give you all those things. If you don't forgive, Allah says, okay, wait here until I come back. And you will wait there for a long time and you would wish that God comes back sooner rather than later to forgive. And next time Allah would ask you, would you want to forgive or wouldn't want to forgive? And eventually, he would make us happy in a way. But if someone says, no, I want justice, justice is there, of course. Now, justice has another meaning. It's not only among people. You know, when I do something wrong, there are consequences for it. And those consequences come back to me. As long as it is possible to wash away those consequences, Allah would do it for us. And that's maghfirah.
So then how does Allah ever forgive shaitan?
You see, if someone really regrets in the bottom of the heart, what should Allah would do with them?
Yeah, if we're all standing against shaitan. Hmm? If I stand up against shaitan and say, well, he caused me to commit the
no.
ideas in my head.
Shaitan never causes anything.
Okay, he put ideas in my head.
Yeah. And that's what the shaitan says on the day of judgment. He says, I did not have any power over you. Are you worried about shaitan being forgiven? No, shaitan never can repent. Be assured of that and would go to hell. Don't worry about it. You know, someone was telling the story of Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi. That Hur did this, Imam Hussein came and Hur stopped him and he didn't allow him to go back. He wanted to arrest him. And when they reached to Karbala, he said, you have to come down here. And the man, of course, knew the story. He said, before he repents, curse him now, because later on he's going to repent and we cannot curse him. So don't worry about that.
No, I guess what I'm trying to say, it's such a complex issue. Like, simplified it so much, which is good, but it just begs a lot of other questions.
Inshallah we go and see how it is. Of course it's complicated. We cannot see all the aspects. Yes, of course.
Doctor, please.